Good morning, Wisconsin. So let's pour that coffee and talk to some experts about what's going on in Milwaukee, Madison, Washington, and beyond. Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. It's the Political Power Hour on WTMJ. Here's your host, Steve Scafidi.
Should we talk about the government?
Let's jump right into Thursday's show, the legal edition today of the Political Power Hour on 620 WTMJ. Yes, I am Steve, and my guest today, he's been here many times before, former U.S. Attorney for Southeastern Wisconsin, Mr. Jim Santel. Good morning.
Steve, always a pleasure to be with you, including this morning.
We always, one of the things I love about you is you do your homework, one. And if I had a moving camera, I'd show the stack of paperwork.
There's a lot of paper over here.
You are a practicing attorney and somebody who certainly digs in deep on this stuff. We're going to start with something that happened, I think you said nine days ago. An executive order that I think sort of disrupts the normal process of government. Explain.
So 9 days ago, Tuesday, February 18th, the President of the United States of America issued one of his many executive orders that he's issued, obviously since becoming president in January of this year. And he said this, along with many other things. He said, no employee of the executive branch acting in their official capacity may advance an interpretation of the law as the position of the United States that contravenes mine. Basically saying the executive, the president, states what the law is, and that's it. And that applies not only to regulations, guidance, positions advanced in litigation. That's everything. Articulating the view, again, first advanced, I would offer, Steve, as you and I have chatted before, also advanced by the Supreme Court, the president can state what the law is. This executive order, to my mind, again, not only in violation of the manners by which various agencies have been established, which we can chat more
about. Which are supposed to be independent.
That's exactly right. There are all kinds of agencies, including one that I believe affects you, Steve, right here, the Federal Communications Commission.
Absolutely.
The Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, even a portion of the Federal Reserve, that huge economic entity right there. Basically, all of those, you got it just right, Steve, have been independent agencies established by the legislature without oversight by the White House. Now, according to what the president has said, that's all changed. He is now responsible for all of their decision making.
In your notes, you use the term autocratic rule.
Yes.
That's sort of a very descriptive term to say, in what layman might say, I am king, you will follow my declarations.
I am king, exactly. And I think that it is supported, if you will, by what the United States Supreme Court did 8 months ago. You and I chatted about it on this very broadcast,
right.
July 1 of last year, in which the Supreme Court, at the pen of our Chief Justice, says what? He says we need to have a person, again, independent, which we acknowledge of other branches. This president has got to be energetic, vigorous, decisive, speedy execution of the laws, cannot be entangled by other things like criminal prosecutions, has to be, again, cannot be feeble, because the feeble executive implies a feeble execution of the government, strong, muscular. Donald Trump is taking that to its real incarnation here and saying once again about a week or so ago that I am now the law in our nation.
Would you go as far as saying those words that you read attributed to the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts, I think you said, embolden the president to take these stances that he's certainly not afraid to take, almost with a daily barrage of executive orders?
Could not state it better, Steve. Again, we look at that opinion, even to this day, as being the one in which, of course, the Supreme Court identifies a category of things that a president can do in office in the White House, for which he, maybe one day she, has no criminal exposure, especially when it comes to the Department of Justice. That's the big takeaway from last July. But the first pages of it, I would offer, are even more important in establishing that great authority. When the Supreme, this is the law of the land, and now Donald Trump has done the bookend, if you will, not only with respect to these independent agencies, I think an awful lot of people believe, across partisan divides, in violation of the ways in which these agencies have been created, when he says only I, or in some instances, the Attorney General, who, yes, by the way, has some responsibility here, we're going to tell you what the law is, and if you don't follow that, consequences will follow as to you.
Yeah, I want to do a whole segment on enforcement, because if you take that stance, that attitude, as the highest ranking governmental official in this country, you know, I think some typical protocols in place for how these things are enforced. Rulings by courts, whether they're the highest court or state courts, if you throw it out the window, there really is no enforcement. We'll get to that in a second. But just going back to the FCC and the National Labor Relations Board, one of the reasons I think these were sort of independent agencies or organizations in some cases is that it did protect from politics and the bias built into politics, which we all know is significant, probably more so today than it's been in maybe 100 and 200 years.
Precisely. And you look at the legislative history behind these and, by the way, other organizations, other entities out there, and you see that that's exactly what Congress wanted to accomplish. They did not want a president to wake up in the morning and say, you know what, my ratings, my poll numbers are not very big. I'm going to tell those folks, I'm going to tell the chairman of the Federal Reserve he's got to reduce interest rates. He's got to do some other things over there. You don't want those decisions being made at that level. Among other things, again, we've talked about the FCC, the SEC, these are big agencies. They were intended to be independent so that political, not only animation, but just the whims of politics would not influence what should be the law-based and fact-based decisions of agency representatives who are independent. Do they have their own personal views? Of course they do, but are not political in nature. That's the design here.
People who call themselves originalists, yes, or there's other terms for we love the Constitution as written, right, and that's the law. We know that it's sort of a fluid document. We've seen that over the, obviously with amendments is the most obvious example of that. But we've also interpretation. The Supreme Court has, we saw it on Roe v. Wade.
Exactly.
And the Dobbs decision, right?
We're still doing a lot of things, again, applying concepts contemporaneously that are maybe implicit, if not explicit, in the Constitution. We do that all the time.
But using that word, originalist, what does the Constitution say, if anything, or clearly, declaratively, about the power of the president?
Right. And so this is plainly Article 2 of the Constitution, right? Note once again, Steve, as you and I have talked, what is Article 1?
I love how you have it ready to
exactly
read.
It's right here, right? And it's there in front of you as well. What is Article 1? You and I have chatted about this both privately and on the air here. Article 1 is the other word we haven't spoken about this morning. The Congress, right? The legislature, James Madison and George Mason, others anticipated that the big representative for the American people would be that Capitol building, right? Not existing at the time. But the legislature is going to be the one that decides all this. Article 2 was not an afterthought, but Article 2, the whole idea behind it was executing what the Congress tells us the law is. Now, there have been obviously many amendments to that along the way, including interpretations of it. But the Article 2 in the Constitution is very explicit about all kinds of things the president can and cannot do, including, for example, the capacity to declare war. That's a congressional action, as we saw, again, probably one of the last times is World War II. All kinds of things specified. And then, as you just accurately noted, the courts have interpreted the Constitution, including powers more broadly, lots of things related to executive orders. Can presidents just sign documents and legislate? The Congress has, in many ways, recently talked about a major questions doctrine that says, you know what, if it's big, if it's huge, and it's new, you can't do it, Mr. President. And so, for example, during the Biden administration under COVID, the president could not do things with respect to businesses, and there have been environmental things. So there are always these interpretations, but the concept has always been, starts with Congress, they define what the law is, they define what these agencies are all about, and, Mr. President, you're the one who's supposed to execute on that.
Let's talk about enforcement after the break. Jim Santel, former U.S. Attorney for Southeastern Wisconsin. Lots to talk about. Your comments, welcome. 855-616-1620. WTMJ, Siding Unlimited. Talk and text line. Quick break on WTMJ. Thanks for finding us on your busy radio day. 620 WTMJ. Steve Spitty along with my friend, attorney and former U.S. Attorney for Southeastern Wisconsin, Jim Santel. All right, so we talked about some of the things that happened from the executive office, the Oval Office, or in Mar-a-Lago, whatever that office is called, because you sign executive orders in both places.
You are the president wherever you may be, whether it's in this nation or overseas.
Yeah, so that's what happened, what already happened. So this is sort of the next piece of this is, yes, if the president receives court rulings that disagree with his take, whether that's executive orders or his declarations that I have this power, which he's done both, what is the recourse here? Because I don't know, we were talking about this before the show, if this has really been tested to this degree before in our nation's history.
Exactly. And we have always abided by the rule of law. Stephen and I have talked about, for example, made reference to these major Supreme Court cases of recent time, Roe versus Wade and Dobbs decision. That's a major one. The reality is an awful lot of people don't like what the Supreme Court's issued over years. This has been a part of our nation's history since day one. And yet what do? We all follow it. It's a piece of paper, right? Issued by nine people. We all follow it. That's the rule of law. Your question is the all-important one. And so there's an increasing concern out there. We have seen it recently in Washington, D.C. We've seen it in Rhode Island when federal district court judges who are presented with challenges to some of these things that the president is doing, including the one D.C. It's a judge named Amir Ali. He was the one who recently has expressed some great concern and told the Trump administration to restore federal aid. There's another judge named John McConnell in Rhode Island. And that, again, has to do with other things having to do with the executive power. In both of those cases, the judges have said to representatives of this administration, you're not following what I told you to do. And while they have declined up to this point to find the government or the defendants in contempt, that plainly it raises exactly the issue that you've identified. Now, you can always appeal from a district court judge, and that's the normal process. But the concern about an executive branch or anyone inside our tripartite form of government and saying, no, I'm not going to follow what the Congress says, what the Supreme Court says, what other courts say, that is a constitutional crisis. People talk about Watergate being a constitutional crisis. I would offer it wasn't. Why?
Why do you make that distinction?
Sure. Because in that instance, what happened? We knew that there were articles of impeachment. Remember also, for those of us, I think you and I are both in that category, Steve, who are alive at the time, Richard Nixon was told by a federal district court judge to produce those tapes. What if he had said no? I'm not producing those. What he did, even in the midst of all of his other troubles, he said, yes, I'm producing all of them. They led to his downfall. There were articles of impeachment. He was about to be impeached, probably convicted. The system worked there. Why? Because Richard Nixon followed the law and ultimately, confronted by members of his own party, left the White House.
Couple texters have asked the same question. I'm paraphrasing. Could not Congress be the enforcement mechanism?
Absolutely. Many, many mechanisms out there. The big one, of course, is oversight, which sounds a little bit weak, but it's significant. The Congress has a major role to play. All of these committees, many of them, have oversight over the specific agencies, including those we talked about before. You call the head of the Department of Labor in. You call the Attorney General in, Commerce, Agriculture, whatever your agency is, and you basically question them and you tell them that when it comes to budgeting issues and other legislative issues, we're going to act to ensure that you're operating in compliance with the law. Beyond that, can Congress pass legislation? That's the other reason it has these hearings. Congress can do all kinds of things. Congress can say, you know what? We are, in fact, changing the way in which these agencies are put together. We're going to increase or decrease the power of the president. We can do that as well. And of course, the big one, which we all know about, it is a huge step, but it's happened a number of times in our lifetime, which is impeachment, right? You can say, you know what? You have so violated the basic standards of our Constitution, Mr. President, that we are going to seek to remove you from office. That's an extreme position, but there are things that Congress can do. I think it's appropriate for all of us to ask today, across party lines, what is Congress doing right now?
And Texter points out, yeah, that was one of the reasons that Nixon eventually had to leave is because Congress actually took,
absolutely,
whether they were doing it behind the scenes or on the floor, they were taking direct action against the president.
Committees in both the Senate and the House doing just that. And again, the system, probably not envisioned in that way by James Madison, the system a couple hundred years later worked.
Real quick, because I know you know the personalities and sort of the policy initiatives and ideas of the U.S. Supreme Court their review of policy and the law. Who is the person, other than the liberal members, who's the conservative side that might say, hold on a second,
right,
here, this is going too far?
Right.
It's probably not going to be Clarence Thomas.
Probably not Sam Alito. Maybe not some of the other so-called sophomores on the court. But we have seen more and more. We have talked about this again in recent broadcasts, Steve, that Amy Coney Barrett is breaking with the so-called conservative majority, which again is an appellation, a way of describing some members of the court, which is probably not always accurate. Just yesterday, the Supreme Court in oral argument seemed to be unanimous in an employment case. So there is unanimity out there. Amy Coney Barrett, more and more breaking in that major case we just talked about from back in July. She wrote a concurring sort of dissenting opinion, which she said, you know what, as to major portion of this, when it comes to trying the cases against Donald Trump, I disagree with you, John Roberts, and this is not the way it should be. She is a parted company on some environmental cases. And then the other person who's out there, again, who we would talk about a lot, which is John Roberts himself. Yes, he has certainly issued an awful lot of opinions in voting rights and environment, and certainly this major opinion in July. But he's also mindful of the fact that this is the Roberts Court. And as much as he has ceded authority in this opinion, you have to think that he wakes up in the morning, goes to bed at night, thinking about his legacy in the Roberts Court. Do you want to be the court that basically cedes all of this authority to another branch of government when you don't have to?
Yeah, maybe not a good look, historically speaking, exactly, for this court. Real quick, after the break, think about this. What the time frame for some of these decisions might be, given that they're at the federal, yes, appeals court level. Jim Santel, our guest for the full hour on the show today. Quick break here on 620 WTMJ. Only got about a minute or so before I get to the ABC News and local news update. We talked about timeline. They're at the federal appeals court level. They're pushing back against the president. Realistically, when might the Supreme Court, in about 30 seconds, can you answer that?
We've got a lot of things percolating up at district courts, appeals courts, maybe getting to the Supreme Court. Maybe sometime later there'll be a petition for a Supreme Court review. Realistically, unless the Supreme Court does a very emergency process, which they could do, they did something even just yesterday with respect to one of those cases. The reality is that substantively, it sometimes takes a year. Remember, we're coming to the end, frankly, in June of sort of this present term. They've got 64 cases on their docket already. It's entirely possible you could see substantive orders coming out in May and June of 2026.
And I got another interesting question that a texter asked that we'll ask you after the break about the power of the Supreme Court justices to do something against the president. Busy Thursday on the program, Political Power Hour. I'm your host, Steve Spitty, along with former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel, who's always a popular guest on the program. I'm not going to sit here and just read all the texts that love you. There's very few that don't like you, so you're winning the popularity.
Oh, well, again, you'd like to think, Steve, as you and I have chatted again, that these issues about the government and how it should work should cross party lines, right? Republicans, Democrats, people on all sides should acknowledge, regardless of what you think about policy and how Congress should enact policy, that these fundamental principles do go back to our founding fathers and their constitutional principles, regardless of how you ally yourself politically, that we should bring to the table on every issue.
And I reminded people about this on the show. So if the Supreme Court validates this idea that the president can simply write out executive orders or actions, and that's the law of the land, and there's no enforcement to do anything about it, you're essentially setting up a system kind of like what we had a revolution about.
I think so.
Where the king just writes orders, right, and everyone has to follow because he's the king.
Right.
Or the queen.
Right.
I understand that, but at some point there has to be some limits. Now I want to quickly get to this because there's a bunch of other stuff. Could the president, it's sort of an if here, if the Supreme Court gives him sort of more absolute power, right, whatever that means, whatever, right, the Roberts Court decides, could he whack members of the Supreme Court? Could he, I mean, figuratively.
Right.
Senators.
Right.
By executive order. Is that a thing?
The answer, of course, is that he can issue pieces of paper with his signature on them, right?
Right.
Right? And the question is whether those can be enforced. You would like to think, again, consistent with our previous comments just a few seconds ago, the president does not have the power to remove Supreme Court justices. There are three ways that you can leave the bench. You can resign. You can retire. And we do have some former justices out there who are involved in civics, doing some great things out there. You can also, of course, be impeached, which has happened just once in our history, unsuccessfully, or as we've also seen recently, if you die in office. Those are the three ways constitutionally that you can leave the positions there on Capitol Hill in the Supreme Court. President does not have the authority to say, you are leaving right now, I am firing you. And yet, all of that is premised upon our belief in a constitution. If indeed at some point the president declares that I am the state, I can do whatever I want, president, and he also has the enforcement ability. That raises a question and opens a sentence that I'm not going to finish here, right? Because we think about that in abject disbelief. Our present system does not contemplate his being able to remove United States senators because he doesn't like them. You can do things certainly in terms of programming and other things with respect to monies, but you don't have the authority just to reach across a branch of government and fire people. You do have some authority when it comes to agencies. That gets back once again to what Congress does and does not do in establishing agencies. The whole idea, the question goes to this issue of checks and balances. When you do those things that are more extreme, the balances are no longer there.
And my last word on this, because we're going to get to the Department of Justice and then the Eric Adams mess that's going on. If you allow this sort of ultimate power of the president, you are setting up a system where when the next election happens, whether that's next in 2028 or 2032, when the other party gets in power, what do you think is going to happen to the laws of the land that typically were created by Congress and precedents and all those things? They're simply going to get reversed probably more than likely.
Absolutely.
And then you have a real chaotic mess when it comes to the state of our country.
You do. And you don't have consistency, which is one of the things the government's got to provide, right? Security, safety, that's fundamental at the top of the list. But also some sense of whether you're a business, you're an individual, that you've got some reliance upon basic notions about the way in which we live and our livelihoods can be pursued. If every 2 years, every 4 years, those things are turned on their heads, completely reversed, when you've got a new president, you've got a new Congress coming in, that is also not consistent with our overall design for government. It's not to say that Congress cannot change the law. It can and it should under appropriate circumstances. The United States Supreme Court from time to time reverses decisions. We embrace that as well. But that's the concern if you've got an all-powerful executive branch or, frankly, an all-powerful court. That if the other branches are no longer checking that, with each change in administration, you will get those swinging doors and the calamity that comes with that.
He is Jim Santel, my guest for the full hour today. We're going to take a break here. We're going to talk about some of the personalities that are now in very important positions across governments, agencies, and departments, including Kash Patel at the FBI and other names that you probably maybe 4 years ago, wouldn't have associated with these high-level positions, but here we are. That's the state of the government. We'll talk about that and more. And don't forget, closing arguments will round out this great hour of radio. That's coming up at the end of the show. You're listening, of course, to 620 WTMJ. Great hour on local radio, which is why I love doing what I do, and I'm not going anywhere. So the texter said, I wish you were on the radio anymore. I appreciate your comments and your feedback, but I'll be around for a while, so God willing. Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's talk about some of the agencies, Department of Justice, certainly departments, FBI, Kash Patel now leading that organization. Dan Bongino, a squawker extraordinaire, podcaster, and give him his credit, former Secret Service agent.
Yes.
I would put them in the less than qualified category, and people may disagree. But they are now in charge. We know that the Department of Justice is going to be transformed in sort of a wing of the White House, which is not really, in my opinion, maybe yours as well, Jim, that how it should work.
Yes.
Talk about some of that, just the structure of these agencies and organizations.
Exactly. We've got appointments to positions like the Attorney General. That's Pam
Bondi,
and she plainly has some background here. She's been the Attorney General of Florida. And then you walk across the street, you've got Kash Patel, who had a little bit of federal service in Donald Trump's first term, really not qualified to be an FBI director, but nonetheless, in a political position. These second-in-command positions, Steve, are all important. And so during the past administration, for example, there was a deputy attorney general named Lisa Monaco. She was running the Department of Justice. I worked with Lisa many, many years ago in Washington, D.C. She's a lifetime career person who knows how things work. And regardless of what your particular views on politics will be, these are the people who run the organizations, who make it work and say, Mr. or Madam Director, what do you want to do? I will make that happen because they know how things work. Dan Bongino, as you just said, I think does not fall into that category. He is someone who, yes, he's got a little bit of law enforcement experience. He is not a career FBI agent. And yes, that's right. Maybe you don't have to be there for 20 years or so. But someone who knows how this huge agency, the premier law enforcement agency in our nation, works not only in Washington, D.C., but right here in Wisconsin, across the nation, who knows how to accomplish law enforcement for the people of our nation. You've got to have somebody somebody in that position who knows how things work. That's not Dan Bongino.
Let me ask you about the Eric Adams situation, yes, because yes, that's directly from the Department of Justice, sort of laying off, taking hands off. Quid pro quo is the term that's been thrown around a lot, right?
Yes.
You do what we want. I'm paraphrasing. Yep. We'll go easy on you or just step away. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
I'm just appalled by it and shocked by it. And that is not hyperbole, by the way. This is a situation where, again, you've seen the acting United States attorney from Manhattan. She has resigned. Other people in the public integrity section who came forward and said, yes, this is a meritorious piece of litigation. Again, Eric Adams presumed innocent until proven guilty by in front of a jury. Nonetheless, the integrity of that prosecution cannot be questioned. And the notion here is, of course, that Eric Adams went to Donald Trump, curried some favor with him. We've seen that publicly as well. And the response is, all right, we're going to move the court to dismiss that case against you. But interestingly, and this is the hitch, without prejudice, and what that, and this is why people are so animated, there's a possibility, if indeed the judge grants that motion, that you could bring this back down the road, Eric Adams. And that's the concern that people in New York, other places have, that Donald Trump now will have this hanging over Eric Adams' head as the mayor of New York City and could bring it back at any time if Eric Adams does not cooperate. The status right now is that there's a federal district court judge right there in Manhattan, and again, his name is Dale E. Ho, and right now he is taking under advisement whether or not he should grant that motion. There's very little authority, frankly, for a judge to say no, but there's some, and he has recently appointed Paul Clement, a non-party to this case, to give him some advice on this and figure out whether or not he should in fact grant this motion, and if so, is it with or without prejudice? The Eric Adams thing is by no means done as of this time.
Which brings me to my next conversation before we get to our last break, and that's the conversation about DOGE, Department of Governmental Efficiency, led of course by the richest man in the world, billionaire Elon Musk. There's a lot of import that job has, apparently, because he's literally fired thousands of governmental workers, some with little warning, mm-hmm, some highly experienced, no real cause for firing other than a new administration. Mm-hmm. I understand the president, Donald Trump, has given him that power.
He certainly has ceded that authority.
But the legal concerns here about someone wielding this kind of power, you must have some of those.
I do. And again, I can be criticized legitimately for being an institutionalist when it comes to government. Like you, Steve, formerly in government, I was there for, frankly, more than 30 years or so. So I'd like to think I know something at least about the Department of Justice. It concerns me profoundly, and it should concern all your listeners, again, on all sides of the political aisle, that you have someone here who presumably has not undergone a background check, which is a predicate for virtually every employment opportunity in the government, somebody who's been given authority. The other thing that, again, it's going to sound linguistic, it's going to sound very wonky, this is not a department. And that's why more and more I'm trying not to talk about DOGE. I'm trying to talk about what Elon Musk is doing. It's not a department established by the Congress where you give an administrator or a director authority and responsibility. This is a unilateral thing established by the president without real constitutional or statutory authority, doing all of these things, including, again, employment situations. And, oh, by the way, directing 3 million federal employees to hand in their homework on what they've done in the past several days. That is unprecedented. It underscores once again the, frankly, I would say, the lack of appreciation for how government works at the White House level.
All right, you've heard Jim make his case after the break. We always do it this way on Thursday. Closing arguments from former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel after this on 620 WTMJ.
Now it's time for your closing arguments.
All right, let's get to it. Former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel, closing arguments.
We talked at the top of the show, my friend, about the exercise of power by an executive. Sometimes said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it's rhymes. I'm not certain I believe in that or not, but let's talk a little bit about history. We happen to be gathering today, Steve, on your wonderful show, on an anniversary in constitutional history. We talked about February 27th, 1951 is a date that a significant number, a sufficient number of states ratified the 22nd Amendment. 22nd Amendment. I know all your listeners right now know this at the top of their head.
Now they're all thinking, what is the 22nd Amendment? You're about to tell us.
Right. And the 22nd Amendment is the one that basically says you can't serve more than two terms in office. There's some variations on that if you take over somebody else's term. All of that happening again some 64 years ago today. And so it brings the issue of history. Let's go back even further than that. Let's go back to King James of England. King James I as my name. He wrote something in 1598 called The True Law of Free Monarchies. I'm not going to read the entire thing. You'll be pleased to know, Steve. But he basically says that the kings are the makers of the laws and not the laws of the kings. James not only ruled without a parliament and ruled again as a complete monarch, but also his son, Charles I, even more authority established under Charles I. It didn't go well for Charles I in the end because of his overreach in that situation. 1642, there was a civil war, and indeed Charles lost his head, led to Oliver Cromwell's Commonwealth, all sorts of other things, again, including, as you made reference before, King George III and our own situation with monarchs. The point of all of that is not to say, again, that history will repeat itself, but just that when we think about our own historical precedents here in America, they are steeped in all of that history where we have said, no, the leaders of our nation are not the laws. We also know as well, probably apocryphal, that King Louis XIV crossing the pond, if you will, over there in Europe, basically said, you know, l'état c'est moi, the state, that's me. There were a couple more kings after him, one of them who also lost his head. We know today that kind of declaration of that I am the state, I am the law, not only doesn't go well for those monarchs and those leaders in terms of long-term history, but the people say no. And that's what I'd call upon America to do today in response not only to this executive order we talked about at the top of 8 or so days ago. Look at that and ask yourselves, again, regardless of what your partisan view is, whether that is something that is consistent with your understanding of your America in 2025. I would offer that everyone says it is not.
A great history lesson from Jim Sensel, my old boss, who's actually my guest on the entire hour Monday, Steve Wexler, would call those dazzling details. Mm-hmm. And you nailed it with your history lesson on why it's so, what's the word?
It's significant.
Foreshadowing of what
exactly,
we are talking about today.
Yes.
Always a pleasure. The brilliant Jim Sensel, former U.S. Attorney for Southeastern Wisconsin. We'll do it again in a few weeks.
My great pleasure, Steve, always.